Let the bankers pay for the crisis of the banks. I think that's an argument that many people would accept. Ordinary people who've never thought about politics certainly wouldn't consider themselves to be Marxists, but they ask themselves all the time, they ask themselves the same question. This question is repeated in every bus stop now, in every marketplace, in every shop, in every street, in every pub. The same question is being asked. The question is this. It's very simple. Look, I, as a worker, if I make a mistake, or as a small businessman, the middle class also are interested in this question, if I make a mistake, then I pay for it. I lose my job, or in the case of a small businessman, I go bust. But here are the bankers sitting on billions and billions or trillions of assets who've made colossal profits in the last period, super profits, who've made a complete mess of the financial situation, have landed whole companies, families, individuals, pensioners, even whole countries, in the case of Iceland. The whole nation has been reduced to bankruptcy by these irresponsible policies, irresponsible even from a capitalist point of view. And yet, are they punished? Are they sacked? They don't even get their fingernails trimmed. On the contrary, they get rewarded. If I make a mistake, I get that. If a worker makes a mistake, I get the sack. If a small businessman makes mistakes, he goes bust. But if a big banker makes a mistake, the state, that's to say the public, ultimately it's the public, it's the taxpayer, it's the poor people that pay the bill for this, hands over billions of dollars. Now, where's the justice in that? Where's the sense in that? People can't see it. No matter which way you look at it, people can't see this. And therefore, people are questioning this. And therefore, our slogan is precisely that. I think it fits in with the general mood of people. Most people would say, let the rich pay. Let big business pay. Let the bankers pay for their own crisis. And certainly, the workers don't accept this. We don't accept that the working class or the middle class should be saddled with this kind of burden. There is, I believe, a change in consciousness. I think in the past, perhaps people saw Marxists maybe as rather unrealistic people, I don't know what, crazy people, fanatics, unrealistic ideas which didn't correspond to the real world. I think that attitude is beginning to change. It's beginning to change because ordinary people are now beginning to question the viability of market economics. Now, I can't resist quoting from this copy of the Financial Times, which I have before me, dated Wednesday, November the 5th. It was just after Obama was elected in America, which, by the way, itself indicates a change, doesn't it? I mean, the fact that in America, people didn't used to vote in America. Nobody voted in America. And here you had people queuing up at 6 o'clock in the morning, queuing up. Now, that must be to vote for a black person, first time in history. Now, there is a change, of course. There's a change in what? Not a change in the political system, because I believe that Obama will turn out to be no different in his conduct and his policies to Bush and Clinton and all the rest of the establishment. He's part of the establishment. Where there is a change, without the slightest doubt, is in the mood of masses of millions of people in America who at least are beginning to question. When you ask these people queuing up at 6 o'clock, ordinary people who never read a political book in their life, who are not Marxists by any stretch of the imagination, ask them a simple question. Why are you voting? Why are you queuing up to vote for Obama? The answer is very simple. We want a change. We're fed up with this. We want a change. And therefore, I would say that is at least the beginning of a mood for change, the beginning of a revolutionary mood, if the truth were to be told, in the United States itself. To return to this article by someone called Christia Freeland, I don't know who this woman is, a journalist from the Financial Times, but she pointed out an amusing thing. This year at Halloween, you know Halloween, they have in America, they have fancy dress parties. They dress up as witches and ghosts and things like that. This year, the fashion was that people turned up dressed up as Sarah Palin, you know, the vice candidate, the Republican vice presidential candidate. But the interesting thing, that in itself is quite amusing, but the interesting point, she goes on to say the following, and I quote, That day, a senior Wall Street executive ruefully predicted to me that next year it will be New York bankers who are the nation's villains of choice. Now, that is quite significant. She goes on, quoting. In private, this is extremely significant, I think. This, of course, is not meant to be read by workers. This is an internal bulletin of the wealthy people, the capitalist class. In private, she says, in private, some of America's most influential business and political leaders are uttering the same warning. Now, that's interesting. With the election resolved, the big political story in the U.S. will be the wave of public anger directed at capital and capitalists, particularly of the financial variety. This is dynamite. And by the way, she quotes here, and I repeat, in case you didn't get it, some of America's most influential business and political leaders at the very top. They're saying, we're in trouble here. You see, this electoral circus managed to distract people's attention for 12 months or more from the issue of the crisis. Now it's over. Yes, and now it's over, and Obama will have to clear up the mess. He'll be presented with the bill. Millions of Americans will say, look, we voted for you, and now we expect action, which, of course, will not be forthcoming. Yeah, I'll just continue this most interesting quote. In recent weeks, a former Clinton cabinet member warned a private equity firm he advises that this new hostility will be the single biggest threat facing the company. An East Coast senator told a lunchtime group of Wall Street supporters that public anger towards them will top the political agenda. And he expressed sympathy for the people's rage. I could go on. Now, this is astonishing stuff to find in page 2 of the Financial Times. It's an indication, I repeat, of a change. And therefore, our manifesto, unlike in the past, far from being, it's not something that's come from the planet Mars, it actually reflects the concerns, the ferment, if you like, the growing mood of criticism that exists, even in the belly of the beast, even in the United States itself, and of course in Britain. Although apparently there's not much happening in Britain, and no big strikes taking place. You see, strikes are not the only index of discontent within society. I believe that there's never been a moment, certainly since the Second World War, in which there was such a degree of ferment in society, a ferment of discontent, as there is at this moment in time. Of course, one could expect that the first reaction of working people will be a shock, of disbelief. They're not Marxists, they don't have the benefit of the discussions as we've had. We're not surprised by this, or we shouldn't be surprised, having discussed it for so many years. There's a state of shock. And, of course, a fear of unemployment. People are going to cling to their jobs. And, therefore, in this kind of climate, you wouldn't expect, at this moment, you wouldn't expect big strikes. But that doesn't mean to say, and that will change, by the way, that will change as the crisis develops, as people begin to wake up to what's really happening. But at the moment, they're in a state of shock, which is logical. You would be in a state of shock, wouldn't you? Many people are in a state of shock. Taken aback by this, they don't know how to react. Yes, but this is only just beginning. It's quite amusing to me to read the press where constantly they say, we've solved it now, we've reached the bottom now. They've said that several times in the last 12 months. They said the same things in 1929, after the Wall Street crash. You read John Galbraith's excellent book, which is, I think, has become a bestseller now, along with Marx's Capital, which has also become a bestseller. In Germany, particularly the eastern part of Germany, I think the sales of Das Kapital have gone up by about 300%. It's not an accident. People are looking for explanations. But Galbraith explains in his book that in the months following the Wall Street crash, on numerous occasions people say, oh, no, there's a rally now. We've touched bottom. The crisis is now we've turned the corner. And they said the same thing. They said the same thing at the time of the Bear Stearns crisis. When was that? 6 months ago? March, more than 6 months ago. And so on. And of course, at each stage, they say, oh, we've turned the corner, now we've turned. And that just is just the prelude to a further collapse a further crisis, a further collapse of prices, and more firm in it. And what we have to say is this, that in any case, it is entirely wrong, I repeat what I said at the beginning, it's entirely wrong to say that this crisis is due to the credit crunch, so-called. That's wrong. You see, in every capitalist crisis, starting in Marx's day, the first stage is a financial crisis. It's like a symptom. The financial crisis comes first, but then the real crisis starts. The real crisis starts afterwards, when it begins to hit the real economy. That's only starting now. Up till now, the last 12 months, 12 or 18 months, all you've had is a crisis in the fundamentally a crisis in the financial sector. That spread to construction, which is linked, by the way, because the collapse of house prices means that people, the builders can't make money, so they stop building. They lay off building workers. This has a knock-on effect, because not only do these building workers, I think about 750,000 building workers in America have lost their jobs in the last 12 months, if my memory serves me right. In addition to the fact that their spending power is drastically reduced, it also means, if you think about it, if people stop, it means a fall in demand for steel, for bricks, for cement, for nails, for hammers, for electrical equipment, for electricity, you name it. It is a knock-on effect. And this effect will only really work itself out gradually. Now you see that the car industry is in a mess in America. The American big car companies are a bust. Chrysler is bust. General Motors is bust. Ford's is bust. This reflects hundreds of thousands of jobs. And not just the car workers themselves. And their families are affected, but other dependent industries. In turn, the crisis of the car industry and the economy in general produces a collapse in oil prices. Price of oil went up to about $140 a barrel a few months ago. Now it's heading towards $55 a barrel. This will affect the oil-producing countries. But it will also affect demand in the oil-producing countries. In other words, what we're dealing here with is a global crisis, as I've expressed it in several documents and articles. Globalization manifests itself now as a global crisis of capitalism. This can't be questioned. It's a simple fact, which you can't argue against. Even the bourgeois economists accept that this is the case. The question is, how do we react? Now, the first thing that we have to say is that this crisis is the product of capitalism. It's the product of market. It's a damning indictment of market economics. They're damned out of their own mouths, these gentlemen, these ladies and gentlemen. Mustn't forget the ladies. These ladies and gentlemen, bankers and so on and so forth. How does it come about that in order to save the banks, if the market system is so clever and is so absolute and is so brilliant and is so miraculous, where's the invisible hand? The invisible hand seems to have been withdrawn. They're in free fall. And therefore they've got to resort to the states, to the state, to the government. Where is the superiority of private enterprise? The Economist actually admitted in an edition which I've got in my bag here a couple of weeks ago that the only way to save the market economy is by state intervention. Well, I mean, that's a contradiction in terms, isn't it? How does it come about? If these guys are so clever, if they're so brilliant, they have to rely upon the government. Of course, the idea is that the government will step in. That's also the idea of Gordon Brown and Alistair Darling and George W. Bush. The government will step in with taxpayers' money, will buy up worthless shares, because they're quite worthless. They're buying rubbish. They're leaving all the profitable stuff in private hands. The state steps in and purchases this useless rubbish, renovates these banks, pours in public money to make them profitable again, and then sell them off, which is monstrous. Our argument is, no, 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 no. And by the way, The argument was, oh, we require healthy banks because otherwise the whole system will seize up, which is true, by the way. The capitalist system requires credit and the free flow of credit in the same way as the human body requires blood. It's like the circulation of credit is like the circulation of blood in the body. If your blood circulation is interrupted, you're in serious bother. You will die. And if the credit system seizes up, then the capitalist system is in serious trouble. And if it permanently seizes up, it will also die. It can't exist. Yes, but the question is, all these trillions of dollars that they've ploughed in, where is the recovery of credit? The banks have taken the money, said thank you very much, and they're still not lending. To the extent, the other day, I don't know if you noticed that, that not just the government, but even the governor of the Bank of England, who's a complete bourgeois, right-wing conservative, was forced to say on the television, look, to the bankers, look, for God's sake, please lend some money to business, or else we'll have to nationalise you completely. All the banks will have to be nationalised. The man actually said this. He was a right-wing conservative. Because the sad fact of the matter is the bankers are not lending. And that's typical of a recession. In a recession, banks do not lend. There is no credit. And the reason the bankers won't lend to other banks, so that's how it works. They lend to each other. And eventually the public gets a slice. But the reason they won't lend to another bank is that nobody knows which of these banks are viable. Nobody knows how many bad debts they have. And therefore, if I lend money to you, am I going to get it back? That's the question. Am I going to get it back? That's the big question. So they won't lend. No matter how much money is poured in, I don't think that they certainly will not solve this. The crisis is going to get deeper. Deeper and deeper. How long will it last? Well, there's all kinds of guesses here. It's all guess, but they don't know. Nobody knows. But now they're increasingly coming around to the point of view which we've had from the beginning. First of all, they denied that there could be a crisis at all. That was the first place. Then when it was carved on their forehead, they said, oh, no, well, it'll only be in America. It won't affect the rest of the world. It's complete nonsense. Contradicts everything they said previously about globalization. We said that. That would not be the case. It would spread to become a world crisis. Then it spread to become a world crisis. They said, well, it'll only be a mild crisis and it won't last very long. Now they're saying, each time they change the tune, now they say something entirely different. Now they say, oh no, this is the deepest crisis since the Depression, and it'll be far deeper than what we thought a few months ago, and will last far longer than we thought. How long? Nobody knows how long. Nobody knows. But it's going to be very serious. And it will affect the lives, the jobs, the houses of millions of people. Millions of people are already affected. Both in America and Britain, the amount of people that are being evicted from their homes is increasing sharply. I think it's gone up in Britain. Repossessions have gone up by about 150% in Britain in the last few months. People are losing their homes. People are losing their jobs. People are losing their livelihoods. And there's a severe attack. And the whole conception is, although they're very careful, they must be very careful how they express it, because they're worried, as this excellent article in the Financial Times indicated, they're seriously concerned now, which they weren't concerned in the past. For God's sake, people are going to question us, are going to question our system, are going to question the capitalist system. They're going to become socialists. They're going to become revolutionaries. That's what this article is saying. And therefore they're going to be very careful, and they present it in very rose-tinted colours. But the fact of the matter is that these colossal increases in debt, in state debt, in public debt, if you look at it dispassionately, look at it scientifically, can only mean one thing: a whole period of cuts and austerities. A whole period. And the whole idea is to put all the burden of the crisis on the shoulders of the working class and the middle class also. That's the name of the game. They tried to present it in nice terms, but that's what it boils down to. So what's our position? Well, our position, first of all, because a Marxist must be active in the labour movement, in the real world, not in the study, but in the real world, we must participate in the trade union branches, in the Labour Party, in the labour movement as a whole. What is our position? Our position is, first of all, no cuts. We don't accept any cuts. We don't accept job losses. If a worker is to be laid off through no fault of his own, our argument is work or full maintenance. That's the traditional slogan of the labour movement in Britain. Work or full maintenance. Either you give us a job and make us productive because we wish to serve society, or else you must guarantee us the full maintenance, a living wage, not just the misery, the miserable sums which are paid out in unemployment benefit. And that must be universally applicable. But above all, we demand the maintenance of employment. If capitalists threaten to close the factories, we should say that these factories should be occupied. That was the slogan put forward by President Chavez in Venezuela. I think it's quite a good slogan in Spanish. Sounds better in Spanish because it rhymes. Fábrica cerrada, fábrica tomada. A factory that is closed is a factory occupied. Occupy the factory under workers' control. That's the way to deal with closures. Because once it's closed, it's closed. It's finished. They will take the machines, they will strip it, they will sell it off to some asset stripping hedge fund company, and you'll be left with nothing. They'll tear the guts out of the place. And therefore, our position would be to take the factories over and maintain them under workers' control, such that they can't be stripped, they can't be destroyed. That these jobs should be preserved, not just for the present generation, but for the future generation. The effects of unemployment, particularly on the youth, are tragic. I mean, they are terrible. You've already got a situation developing in Britain and in all countries of lumpenization, of demoralization of sections of the youth, unemployed youth with no future, living in bad conditions, in appalling housing estates, and so on and so forth, or dead-end jobs and so on, or unemployed. And then they're surprised they've got things like murders and knife attacks and drugs. These are elements of barbarism which already exist in a country like Britain, and all countries get the same phenomenon. Therefore, our task is to save the youth. And the way to save the youth is by giving the young people a proper education, a guaranteed decent education for all youth, free education, at all levels, up to university level. Should be the case. It was the case in the past. No reason why it should not be the case now. Proper education, decent housing, and a decent job with equal wages for all. The basic slogan of our movement. Equal pay, equal wages for work of equal value. This is what we must fight for. You see, our criticism of the reformist labour leaders and trade union leaders is not that they stand for reforms. We don't criticise them for that. Our criticism is that they don't stand for reforms. Or leastways, they don't conduct a serious struggle for reforms. We should challenge them. That we must work out a serious programme. Let them turn around and say, oh, we can't afford it. There's no money for this. Why is there no money for it? Nobody believes that anymore. If there's trillions for the bankers, why is there not trillions for other things which we need, which we require? Let them answer that argument. And therefore, I believe that the programme which we put forward is a realistic programme, which meets the needs of the masses. But our basic argument is this. You see, you can't cure cancer with aspirins. Drastic problems require drastic remedies. And it is clear that this universal crisis, this global crisis, which has the most terrifying effects, and it's only just begun, people have not really grasped the seriousness of the situation. The only way of dealing with this is by dealing with it at the root. Enough of this nonsense, this piffle about credit crunch and so on and so forth. This is a product of the capitalist system itself, of the market economy itself. And therefore, the idea of nationalisation has already been raised now. It's quite amusing. I remember I think it was 1983, Rob will correct me, I think it was 83, in the election, when the Labour Party put in its manifesto, they just mentioned, that it didn't emphasise it. They mentioned the vague possibility of nationalising the banks. Oh, there was a furore. The press crucified the Labour Party. They said, oh, no, they described Labour's manifesto, 1983 manifesto, as the longest suicide note in history because they dared to mention the possibility of nationalising the banks. Well, now just about, what, 20 years later, George W. Bush and Gordon Brown are nationalizing the banks. What are you talking about? It is necessary to nationalize the banks, but it's not necessary to nationalize the banks like this, paying them colossal amounts. No bailouts, that's all right. No, none of this nonsense. No bailouts. The banks should be expropriated because they are necessary to society. Everyone agrees that credit is necessary to society. And that the private capitalists have made a complete mess of the entire business. Therefore, it should be expropriated and run under workers' control and management in such a way that the banks and the insurance companies and the other financial institutions can be planned and used for the benefit of the whole of society. That would allow us, for example, to provide cheap mortgages for anyone that required them, cheap credit for small businesses, for small farmers, small shopkeepers, and so on and so forth, and generally provide the necessary flow of investment in order to keep society, keep industry moving, to keep the jobs going. Nationalize the banks, absolutely necessary in order to, it's a fundamental lever for the control of economic life, and it should be taken out of the hands of the parasites and the fat cats and the people that have ruined the economy. It's necessary, but it's not enough. You see the problem of the car industry that's threatening to lay off people, the problem of Woolworths and all these supermarkets, all these enterprises which are either closing down or sacking workers. We say, no, enough of this. It is necessary to nationalize not only the banks and the financial industries, but to nationalize the banks, the insurance companies, and the major industries, the big companies, including the big supermarkets, Tesco's, Sainsbury's, Asda's, MFI, Woolworths, and develop a rational strategy for the production and the distribution of goods within a socialist planned economy. That's the only real solution. Anything else is a lie and a deception of the masses. It's a lie and a deception of the people. It just does not hold water. What is necessary is a root and branch change of society. That's our position. That's the facts. The facts of the matter. It's the fact, yes, it is the facts of the matter. However, we have a problem. We have a duty. We have a task. And that is to persuade people, to convince people by argument that this is what is necessary. I think in the case of Eastern Europe, we have some comments from Eastern Europe here, it wouldn't be too difficult. People are already saying in Slovakia and other countries, and to my knowledge, in Hungary and Poland, well, goodness, we were better off before for all the faults. At least we had jobs, we had work, we had houses, we had a future. Not like this mess. So what we would say is this. It is necessary. However, we have to convince people, not just by arguments, but through their own experience. As a general rule, the masses, the millions of ordinary working people, don't learn from books. Not because they're stupid, they're not at all stupid, but they don't have the time or the possibilities because of the problems of life under capitalism. It restricts this. But people learn from experience. Working people learn from experience. Lenin, of course, was a very great theoretician. He once said that for the masses, an ounce of practice is worth a ton of theory. And he was a very great theoretician. He didn't play down the importance of theory. But for the masses, it's experience that counts. They're now passing through a very big experience, through a very painful school, but a very necessary school, the school of capitalist crisis. They will draw conclusions. And our task is to help them to draw those conclusions, not to lecture them like little school kids, as the sectarian grouplets do. They lecture the workers in the most foolish manner. Workers don't require being lectured. But they have to go through this experience, and it does help that there is, and there must be, a strong, organized Marxist current, which is what we are, the international Marxist current, a strong, organized current within the broad mass of the labor movement, which participates in the day-to-day struggle. Every struggle. Every struggle to defend every job, every social conquest, in education, in health, in housing, you name it, we should be the first. We should be the first ones there, advancing serious transitional slogans, which make sense to the workers, and using this to raise consistently the fundamental idea of the need to change society. It's very good if we win a strike or we win this demand or that demand, that's very important. And by the way, without the day-to-day struggle for advance under capitalism, the socialist revolution would just be an empty phrase. It's only through the day-to-day struggle that the workers acquire the experience and a sense of their own power, which leads them on, if you like, to bigger things. That's how it works, precisely. And therefore, we have to link our scientific revolutionary Marxist ideas to the real, concrete, day-to-day struggles of the working class and the mass of the middle class, who are also oppressed by the capitalist system. However, within these struggles, we must consistently raise the same question, the fundamental question, that none of these successes, where we are successful, where the workers are successful, none of these successes can mean anything unless and until we carry out the expropriation of the capitalist class. I think we must have a similar position, saving the differences, to a famous Roman called Cato the Elder. He was a reactionary old swine, actually, but he was a very effective politician. And in the wars against Carthage, the Punic Wars, there were three or four wars against Carthage. Cato, who understood that Carthage had to be destroyed, that they, you know, in order that Rome should consolidate itself as a power in the Mediterranean. Every time he went to the Parliament, the Senate, he could be speaking on any subject. It could be housing or the drains or rats or books or anything, or agriculture or manure or any subject. No matter what, he always finished with the same slogan. Delenda est Carthago. Carthage must be destroyed. And then he would sit down. Well, I think we could be a little bit more subtle than Cato. But it is necessary that no matter what struggle you're involved in, no matter what issue that you're raising, and we must always start with the issues which make sense to people, whether they're workers or students or anything else, the issues that they're interested in, the concrete issues. But it's our duty to always constantly raise as a central idea, the need to change society, the need for a socialist transformation of society, without which nothing else is possible. To put it in a nutshell, the capitalist system must die in order that humanity might live. And to use Cato's expression, capitalism must be destroyed. Capitalism must be destroyed and replaced with a higher system, a genuinely humane, democratic system based upon the needs, the aspirations, the cultural life, the creativity of the mass of humanity, which we call socialism. Thank you.